Well, as I mentioned, you live down here, and it's an incredible property. Do you ever get tired of the view that comes with it?
I don't. I enjoy getting up in the morning. I live here on the farm, and I have a little ritual where I'll get up early and grab a cup of coffee. I go to our sunroom, which looks out over the farm. I'm looking at the inn, the golf course, and all, and I never get tired of it. It's just it's an amazing view, and I realize that I'm super blessed to be able to live out here, but also, live in Alabama and live in this country. We take it for granted, but it's an amazing privilege to live here. So I try to remember that every day.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the farm. It's just to get everybody up to speed in case people aren't familiar with Purcell Farms. It's a 3,200 acre farm that has been in your family for generations. And I know that you personally have lived out here for nearly four decades. Tell us a little bit about sort of how important it has been in your family and, what it was like even when you first moved out here. Again, you've lived out here for four decades, so I know you've seen a lot of changes. Tell us a little bit about what it's been like as a part of your life, just the farm itself and the property.
Well, I grew up in an agriculturally based family. We owned a fertilizer business, and first jobs I ever had was working within the family business. And we've always been about the land. As I look back at my grandfather, he would buy and sell land based upon its ability to grow a crop or raise cows or to grow hay or to whatever. And he'd kind of get tired of it, and he'd trade it for another few thousand acres somewhere else. So when I was growing up, it was pretty much just being tutored under that kind of mindset. But when I came out to the farm, I just left Auburn, got married, started having children. In fact, we had six children. And the cool thing about our home back then was we had two four-wheelers, and we had this huge piece of land with all these dirt roads and that type thing. So that would be kind of some of the excursions that our family would make. At one time we didn't even have a TV set. We would just kind of take off and go on these adventures, and we would spend hours and hours and hours just going around the farm, what is now Purcell Farms, that nobody ever got a chance to see. So being a creative mind, I and also being an avid golfer, even back then I loved to play golf, I began to kind of see what the potential would be on a piece of land like I was enjoying back at the time. Although I was in my early 20s, I didn't have the means to do squat. So it was just kind of something I stored. I guess you could say I stored it up in my heart. But it was an amazing time to really get to know the land before it ever got transformed into the purposes that we used it for over the years, or certainly what it is now.
And I want to get into that in a minute, kind of how it's transformed. The land has transformed over the years. But where's your favorite spot on the property?
Probably on top of Calibiate Mountain. It's a place called The Secret Place. I think you've been up there before.
I have, and after this podcast, it won't be so secret anymore.
Well, it is. It's an amazing spot on the property. It's about 1,000 feet above sea level. It's got this wide-scale view shed on both sides of the mountain, both kind of east and west. So it's a great place to go see the sun rise, and it's a great place to see the sunset. It's also a great place to get engaged and to do a lot of different things up there. We will have guests come up, come to the farm, they have never been to that spot. Anytime I'm giving a site visit, if somebody's never been here, I'll take them and show them all the cool things, the buildings and the different venues. But I'll always say that the most impressive thing that they will see will be what I show them last, and that is the secret place. Because everybody that goes up there, their mouth drops open and just say, oh, wow. You're looking down on the Lay Lake and the Coosa River, look back at Sylacauga, see all the quarries. You could see all the way to, you know, Double Oak Mountain in Birmingham, looking down kind of over Shelby County, really. And it's just an amazing sight. But nobody really would know about that unless they came to Purcell Farms.
And the ride-up is treacherous. I can attest to that as well.
Nobody has died or gotten hurt yet.
Well, you know, I want to talk a little bit about how this property has transformed itself. But I also think that, you know, part of that story is your family's business. And as you mentioned, your family was in the fertilizer business. And, you know, that is a business in which you've worked since age 12, or at least I know that you were in the cotton gin, right, shoveling cotton seed at age 12, and you've been at it ever since. And, you know, the fertilizer business that your family was in, that started out as the Sylacauga Fertilizer, grew, and all of that was sort of the first domino when, was it your great-grandfather, I believe, started the fertilizer business?
He did, my great-grandfather. That was in 1904. It was the radius that he serviced was maybe a 10 or 12 mile, you know, radius of Sylacauga. And he was also the L&N rail clerk in Sylacauga. Sylacauga was mainly known because two rail lines, the L&N and I guess the CSX, crossed. And that's kind of how Sylacauga got here. You had a crossing of two railroad lines that came through here. So my great-grandfather ran that business until he died in 1930. My grandfather, who was my mother's father, moved back from Atlanta, took over the family business. He ran it until the early 60s, but my father had come in. Now, my father married into the business. So it's been all these different generations of people, again, about the land, the fertilizer business. There were a lot of cows involved always. And the mealtime conversations I just remember about the company. So I was, even though I was young when I was coming up in the business, I actually was not sheltered from really anything about the fertilizer business itself. So I learned a lot just around the dinner table. And then all through high school I worked in the family fertilizer plant here in Sylacauga. Went to Auburn, came back every summer, worked on the family farm here, or doing something with the family business. So I, when I get out of Auburn in December of 1980, it was never even a thought of going to work anywhere else. I mean, this was something I knew.
Is in your blood.
It's in my blood, but it was a passion because I knew so much about it. It's kind of like, hey, this is my family heritage. But I was a commercial art major in Auburn, so I was very creative, very much coming up with ideas. Probably ADD in high school, even though that, you know, it wasn't even back then. Nobody was talking about ADD. You could get pills for stuff like that now, but you couldn't back then. And I was always distracted by something else. But it all worked out, you know, well. We had this great, you know, run in the fertilizer business for probably about, I don't know, 85 years. And then we started getting involved in more technological advancements. That's when we got involved in controlled release fertilizers.
And this is, you bring something up, which is, you know, there's normally in a successful business, often at least, the owners, people who work in the business can point to one critical turning point in the business and how that led to success. Y'all had a couple, and this is probably in your story, this is one of the first ones, is the technological advances that you made in it, that were really cutting edge in the fertilizer industry worldwide. And so what is it specifically that your company discovered, developed, that really was such a critical turning point in the business?
Yeah, so the evolution of fertilizer is that my great-grandfather would capture things that came out of the back end of an animal. You know, that was considered to be fertilizer. And then,
so maybe that was the first turning point right there.
Well, I knew I probably didn't want to deal with that the rest of my life. But technology got better and better. Fertilizers got higher in analysis. They started coming out with ureas and ammonium nitrate, different things that it took much less product to actually do to perform a job, whether it be on corn or cotton or anything like that. But in the 1950s, we developed a brand name called Stagreen, and that was, my father was the brainchild of that, and so we had been in agriculture exclusively up until then. And when we came up with Stagreen, we entered the what we call the consumer lawn and garden type fertilizers, also ornamental nursery growers, pots of roses or azaleas, things like that, and golf courses. Okay, so there was a time that I remember we were in all four of those. We were in agriculture, you know, consumer, golf, and ornamental nursery. And we ended up selling our consumer fertilizer company in 1997, okay? So you go from 1904 to 1997. My brother, Taylor, who lives in Birmingham, he decided to go with the entity that was putting that together. In fact, he was kind of instrumental in that, and it was a big time deal. Consumer, let's see, it was Citicorp Venture Capital funded it, and he loved that consumer side of the business, and it was really the biggest part of our business, had probably the highest promise at that point in time. But we had developed this technology called Polyon, and it was amazing technology. It was kind of like rocket fuel compared to kerosene. And you know, again, we're from Sylacauga, Alabama, okay? I can't under or overemphasize that more, because we were competing against companies that were, publicly public companies. They were operating in, you know, foreign countries and whatever. And we were just a Sylacauga, you know, we only had one plant, and it was right here in downtown Sylacauga.
And yet y'all developed this high tech fertilizer formula.
We did. And it was patented. And the cool thing about it, it was a polymer coating that we could put on any type of fertilizer product. We had developed the process to do that. The thicker the coating that you put on, and this was just microns thick. It was not like piled on. It was very, very thin because the coating itself was very expensive. But the thicker the coating, the longer the product would last. Okay, so, and we had four different particle sizes for every product. So if it was a coated urea, we had four different sizes, mainly for, you know, we had kind of an ag grade that was big that you could literally fly it on in a helicopter. But then we had a product that would be used for like a field or golf course roughs or fairways or greens. So if you can imagine, it needed to get finer and finer the smaller that it got. But the cool thing was is we could make it last, say, I mean, we could make it last for anywhere from 6 weeks to a year and a half. And that was that had never been done before. So we had this patented technology that worked great that nobody knew about, and we had to figure out a way, how are we going to tell the world about and educate the world about this unbelievable fertilizer product.
So you're here in Silicaga, Alabama. You've got this amazing product, which is cutting edge, something that frankly the world had never seen before. So you're presented with this challenge of how is it that we create this awareness to all of our potential customers out there. And as a result, you came up with a really innovative sales and marketing technique. You brought all your customers here to Silicaga, Alabama.
Yeah, well, let me back up a little bit, because so in 1997, we sold the consumer fertilizer business, and that same time, the leftover part of the family business, since Taylor was gone, he was president of what was then called Stay Green Plant Food Company. And we created a new business, even though it was an extension of the family run and the fertilizer business. And I was made CEO. It was the first time I was ever CEO of anything.
Previous to that, now you had obviously worked in the company, and, yes. And I think you were in advertising, sales, marketing, that branch of the company. Is that correct?
Yes. I'd run an in-house agency for a while, and then I got involved in sales, sales management, marketing, all of that. But I was never the decision maker. Now, as CEO, it's kind of like, all right, David, it's your chance to kind of do your thing. You've got to come up with whatever it is. And at that time, my father was backing out of the day-to-day part of the company. So this was really my baby to run with. And it was an exciting time, but it was also kind of scary when you think about it, because we had a lot riding on it. At the time, we had very little sales. We were still trying to kind of figure out how we were going to put this company together. But our main goal was to take this rocket fuel, this Polyon technology, and figure out how are we going to get this fertilizer technology applied to every golf course in North America. I mean, that was the grand deal. Now, we had some other markets it would go into as well, like specialty agriculture and ornamental nursery. But we had to figure out how are we going to get distribution on the West Coast, you know, down into Florida, the East Coast, Canada, Midwest. I mean, again, we were Silicaga, Alabama-based fertilizer business. So we just figured all that out. We went into it and we said, okay, we have got to build a customer base that they're going to have to understand what this product is. Is you can't just make a flyer on it and them get it, because we were a much higher price product, but we knew that if our potential customers, our prospective customers, if we could convince them and tell them the story and have them understand it, that we couldn't come up with a reason why they wouldn't buy it, because it's just a matter of getting the point across to them. So that's when we developed the strategy, which you're probably wanting to talk about next, and that is how we decided to move our fertilizer company headquarters from downtown Sylacauga out to Fayetteville, Alabama, about 10 miles outside of town, and on the family property, which is now Purcell Farms, and to create this visitation strategy whereby we would invite prospective customers to Alabama, to the farm, And we would be able to state our case in a totally paid for 3-day, 2-night trip, for no more than 20 people at the time. And we did that twice a week for 42 weeks out of the year. Now these customers, you know, they would come in from, it was generally regional. So they would either come in from Florida or Texas or California or the Northwest. Sometimes they'd come in from different places in Canada.
How many would you bring in at a time?
No more than 20. It was because that was, everything was sized for that. We didn't have that, you know, we had 21 rooms on property, but we had set up a system that absolutely worked. We called it the Experience at FarmLinks. And over the years, we've hosted over 10,000 golf course superintendents here.
Okay, but now let me back up a little bit here. Now, something has changed, obviously, in the property, because you're bringing in golf course superintendents. You had your family's farm, your family's property, which was cattle, pastures, and then at some point, you made the decision to build a golf course, which is an incredibly risky proposition, but it's really the linchpin in this whole thing.
Well, it was actually a little bit later in the process that the golf course actually got built. It was master planned, but the first thing we built out here was our company headquarters, and then we added the accommodations for our customers, and that was called Parker Lodge. But we really had it down. I mean, again, it was just 20 people at the time. But we had a real tricked out bus. We'd pick everybody up in at the airport. I'm telling you, it was really, really cool for the time. This is in the late 90s. But so we were trying to put our best foot forward with people that we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have one chance to make a first impression, so to speak. So we wanted to kind of showcase the family business, but also the family, and you know, eventually we get to the product. But what we knew was we had to build a relationship with these people first before we would get them to buy anything from us. It's essentially building trust. The trust was built over this 3-day period of time, and you know, I could imagine some of the listeners out there saying, "Well, how are you going to build trust in 3 days?" We built it because we had their undivided attention for 3 days, 2 nights. It's really about 48 hours, and we watched their countenance, everything, their body language, everything changed as we applied Southern hospitality to them, mixed with this introduction of technology and then a show and tell in a way that nobody else was doing it. Everything we did, nobody else was doing at the time. That was the big risk. It wasn't just the golf course. It was everything that we were doing. We kind of rolled the dice on trying to get to know people in this very unique way. But in the end, we found out that, you know, they were almost beholden to us at the end. We had fed them so well and treated them so well. They stayed in one of the nicest places. Parker Lodge has got all this taxidermy, and, you know, my wife decorated, had the best beds and pillows, and, I mean, everything was great. We had a private chef that did all the meals right there. They were catered to completely, given nice Bobby Jones shirts, and then in 2001 we started construction of FarmLinks Golf Course, which was always planned, but we had to kind of do it over time. In 2003 they were able to not only understand what the fertilizer product Polyon would do for them, but they were definitely able to see in a real living laboratory how this product worked. And then we could put our competitors' products right up next to ours, And I can assure you that not one time did the competitors look better than ours.
I would imagine that word got out pretty quickly amongst the golf course superintendent community that, hey, you've got to go to Farm Links and you've got to go talk to David Purcell. You've got to see this. I mean, did you sense that amongst your customer base?
I still do. You know, it's funny because I will go somewhere to some golf course that maybe I've never played before, and I've forgotten that their superintendent has actually been to the course, and then I'll run into him, and he will begin telling me memories of his trip down here, and he said, you know, I remember meeting your mom and your dad, and I remember, you know, doing this, and I remember going up to the top of the mountain. I remember the big bear in Parker Lodge. So it was really all about, you know, you're creating a relationship, but you're also creating memories. And it's eerily kind of like, you know, do you know where you were when you heard that Elvis died? Well, now they can tell me every detail of their trip to the farm because it's so unlike. They only did it like one time. And
well, I tell you, when you drive in, for anybody that visits in the future or has visited, when you drive in and you come over that first hill when you see the golf course for the first time, if there's a prettier spot in Alabama, find it for me. And I would imagine that when you drive anybody in, now I know we're still got some more to tell about that part of the story, but that in itself would hook anybody.
Yeah, so it's a pretty easy sell when you get people here, and so we just tried to make it very relaxing, very enjoyable. It's kind of like setting the table for a nice meal or something along that line, and every group was a little bit different that we brought in, but the whole idea was we were able to spend time with these people and get to know them. And it was a small group, so we got to know, okay, tell me about your family, your wife, and all of that. And they got to know us too. And those are the type of people you want to do business with. I mean, really. So we got so far along in that. I mean, we had partners. We had Toro was a partner. BASF was a partner. Club Car, still a partner here. We had kind of thought through everything, and it was, even if somebody wanted to copy it, it'd be pretty hard for them to do it just because it's a huge investment on our part. And it was something, as I look in my rearview mirror, you can pat yourself on the back and say, yeah, it worked out great. But we didn't know that at the time it was going to work out as good as it did. But of course, we did that up through 2005. In 2005, we had three companies come knocking on our door and said, hey, we'd like to buy your technology, your business and all. And the farm was never going to be for sale. This was just a marketing tool that we used to build the business up. Then we had this, you know, this nice earnings pattern, and the business was growing. We were, you know, tops in the country and doing this thing. We had customers that loved us. And I had a feeling that it was probably about time to, if we had the opportunity to cash out, it might be a good time to do it, even though at that point in time we were 102 years old from the time that my great-grandfather started the business. But so we ended up selling the company in 2006 to a company called Agrium. And after that, Agrium actually moved here, and I became kind of a marketing guy. I was not the guy running the business anymore, and it was not near as fun as it was when I was kind of calling all the shots and that type of thing. So we exited the fertilizer business in 2006. You know, it's funny when I'm describing that, because they say, well, 2006 to 2019, what all happened in that? And I said, well, it's probably a lot like Moses walking in the desert, you know, trying to find the promised land. And he keeps kind of looking over there, but he can't get in there, can't see it. So we've been really trying to figure out what we needed to do and how we were going to do it to get into the hospitality business. I mean, we've always been in hospitality. We just used it for business. We weaponized Southern hospitality.
Well, I was just about to say there's it seems as if you've transitioned to another product that you sell down here at Purcell Farms, and that's Southern hospitality. And I know that that's the kind of a common thread that ran through your sales strategy, and then even after it has lived on as an element of your business or a product essentially of your business, it's lived on even after you've sold the fertilizer company and now you've become a renowned resort. It really is at the core of your business, you're marketing Southern hospitality. Isn't that the case?
It's definitely the case. And we compete against some pretty well-funded competitors out there, been established longer than we have. But I will say that we've been in Southern hospitality for a long time, and we understand it. I think the difference in Purcell Farms and, say, a Marriott Rossbridge or a lot of different places that you might go to, the owners of the property live here, okay? Someone may say, well, why does that matter? Well, because it just matters more to us. This is everything that we do here is a reflection on the family, and the family is our brand. Now we don't have a fertilizer product per se, but so we want to do things well, excellently, and we love hosting people.
Well, okay, you mentioned you live on the property, and as I alluded to with just my anecdote at the beginning here, that you're within a 3-wood of the golf course now. What are the challenges, though, that go with it? I know that it helps you really monitor everything that's going on at Purcell Farms, and I know that you're able to interact with everyone from guests to maintenance workers to people in between. But what are some of the challenges that presents? I mean, you're 2 minutes from your office, David. I mean, that's pretty unique in itself. And when something goes wrong, I'm sure that people expect now, there's an expectation that you're going to be accessible, available. Has that ever been a problem?
I mean, I don't know if it's a problem. It's just kind of where we are right now. My wife calls it like living above the storefront.
That's a great analogy.
And so we're always going to be the worst critics here. We see stuff all the time. I'm walking around. I'm a what they call a maximizer on my StrengthFinder assessment, and I'm also I'm futuristic, strategic, an ideator, adaptable, but I'm a maximizer. Maximizer means that I'm walking around not looking at stuff that's done well. I'm looking at stuff that could be done better, and my wife's the exact same way. And so what we have to do is be careful that we don't just go to our employees, our managers, and always just kind of dogging them about, hey, this could be better, this could be better. Because they do a lot of things really, really well. I mean, we got a 97% excellent rating by TripAdvisor. There's no other place in the eastern United States that I've seen that's that high. That means 97% of our guests that come here could not rate us any higher. It's unbelievable. But I can always point out things that, is not done to our liking. My wife's the same way. We go home, we talk about it. And we've got ways of kind of getting that across to our staff. So they know we have very, very high expectations. But to me, that's what makes a place great. And a family-owned company like that, if the family leaves and you now put this in the hands of managers that work for some resort that's based in Chicago or West Palm Beach or something like that, it's not going to be the same. So I think that's the main thing that people would notice here is that. The our employees in a way are an extension of the family because they realize that we have the highest expectations at all times.
And you've got a lot to offer. I mean, just to back up for a second, Farm Links is here. You've got an Orvis Shooting Grounds facility that's here. You've got the resort. You've got wedding facilities. I mean, Purcell Farms has really evolved into it's really an incredible destination with amenities. I know. I mean, it's one of those things where oftentimes people don't realize exactly what's here now. And so, just if you don't mind, just taking a second and just kind of running through for people that are unfamiliar with everything to offer at Purcell Farms. I do think it's when you and I are sitting here talking about this family business. I mean, it's something that y'all keep building as well.
Yeah, there's always something brewing somewhere. But yeah, so now, you know, obviously we started off with 3,200 acres. The golf course, Farm Links, has been open for 16 years now, and it was voted once again number one in the state of Alabama by Golf Week, which we're very proud of, since the Robert Trent Jones Trail is, you know, they have, I don't know how many golf courses they have, but they are, they kind of round out the rest of the top 10, though. So we're I call it, we're head of the trail, so to speak. But, so we do golf well. We still do, at times we'll bring in superintendents and do some things along that line. We have a partnership with Club Car still, but we've added this Orvis Shooting Grounds, which is amazing. The family that owns Orvis, the Perkins family, was looking to put an Orvis experience in the middle of the southeastern United States, which is their biggest market. They wanted to draw people to a place where that they could experience their brand. And so they called us, and they had heard about us from a recommendation. And I remember talking to one of the family owners, and I flew up to New York to see one of these types of facilities, and went through that. He came down here. We literally drew up the contract on, I call it like the back of a napkin. It wasn't like, you know, hours or days or weeks or months dealing with lawyers or something like that. It's just two family-owned companies coming in and saying, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And so the shooting grounds, they deal with Orvis, obviously deals with upland bird hunting and fly fishing. I mean, they know everything about that, and they got this incredible line of clothing that I've been buying for years. Just really, really a great amenity. So it rivals Farm Links. The greatness of Farm Links is we've got this shooting amenity on the front end of the property. So out of those two things, we now have 81 guest rooms. We've added two new restaurants, so we have actually three different places that you can eat. The Golf Grill, it would be the other one. We have Hamilton Place, which is it's a wedding venue, but it's also an event venue. It'll hold about 350 people. It's brand new, it's amazing. The landscaping around it's amazing. It's right up next to an old antebellum home. We're beginning to really get a lot of weddings there on weekends, and we do corporate events during the week. But you know,
and it's really decorated with some, you've got some cool stuff here for people to see. I know we talked about earlier that you've got a piece of Renaissance art that has some pretty interesting history inside the resort.
Yes. So I know we hadn't talked about this yet, but Jim Nabors, Gomer Pyle.
I hope we do. I wanted to make sure not to miss this part of it.
Yeah.
Because it's a really neat part of the story of the Purcell family.
Well, I got to start with that. But Jim Nabors grew up in Sylacauga, Alabama. Okay. And he was born in 1930, went to Sylacauga High School. Was very good friends with my mother's family. My father is playing in a high school football game in Sylacauga for the Talladega Tigers, okay? So Sylacauga versus Talladega, two in-county schools playing against one another. My father breaks his leg in Sylacauga at his senior year, and that was his last football game he ever played in. Jim Nabors actually garners up a group of students from Sylacauga High School. They all go see the Talladega Star that got his leg broken in the Sylacauga Hospital the next day. And so they really struck up a friendship, which went through college. But while they were in college, Jim Nabors invited my dad to my mother's home. My mother was 4 years younger, but Jim Nabors asked him. He says, "Hey, they've got this brand new invention. It's the coolest thing. It's called an electric razor. And one of my friend's fathers has one. Let's go over to his house and see it." So they go over, go in there, checking out this razor, and then my mother comes walking in. My dad, you know, sees her. There's this instant attraction. They begin a courtship, and they end up getting married. Jim Nabors, this is way before he's famous. He's just a high school kid, college kid. He, my grandfather loans him $300 for a one-way ticket to California to go to Hollywood to go get his start in show business. It's kind of like, hey, you go out there. And he was immensely talented, really, really funny guy. Okay, so fast forward now. He in 1963, he gets his break on the Andy Griffith Show, does that. He'd never acted before in his life. And at the end of 1964, the fourth season of the Andy Griffith Show, he spins out, starts, and does the Gomer Pyle USMC. Does that for 6 years. Those are both number one shows on TV. A guy from Sylacauga, Alabama, is now the star or one of the stars in the Andy Griffith Show, and he was the star of Gomer Pyle USMC. So he used to come to our house all the time. So we've always had this friendship. I've known him. And so kind of fast forward, now we've got Purcell Farms out here. He's coming to visit my mom and my dad on a regular basis, probably about once a year or once every other year. He'd bring friends but he would always say that, hey, I've got this cachet of stuff from my Beverly Hills mansion. When he moved to Honolulu in 1975, he packed everything up from Beverly Hills, put it in storage, and moved it to Honolulu. Okay, so he had all this stuff, and now he's 84 years old. So now we've kind of raced through his life here. About 5 years ago, he invited my wife, Ellen, who is our executive decorator here. She's decorated everything. She's picked out every paint color, you know, every linen, every curtain, you name it. She's amazing. And he invites us to go out, and he says, hey, you can have anything from my Beverly Hills home. He says, I don't need it. It didn't fit my motif of my diamond head Oahu home. So we flew out there, and we go into this storage unit. Jim Nabors, we set him on a stool, and we open these doors, and there's all these boxes meticulously packed, meticulously marked, and there's this one piece of this wooden carving that's in the front that's not covered. It's just sitting there. And so I'm like, well, tell me about this, Jim. He says, after my acting career, I used to go to Europe, and I would get on these river boats, and I would entertain at night, but during the day I'd get a driver and go around to different little shops. So I go into this one little shop, and it had all these antiques and things in there, all this old stuff. And he said, I fell in love with this carving that's the Madonna and Child. It's this, the thing weighs about 400 pounds. It's mahogany. Yeah,
I don't know how you got it on the wall. That was one of the things I was amazed at.
Yeah, that was an engineering feat. Yeah. But anyway, so he says, you know, I saw this and I just loved it. And I said, well, tell me more about it. He says, well, it was done by this guy named Luca Della Robbia. And I'm like,
you have an art background. I want to tell everybody, you got an art background. And so you studied art at Auburn.
Art and art history, and I went to Italy back in 1979 for a summer and did some things there. But this Luca Della Robbia, who can forget a name like that? So I'm like, okay, all right, well, tell me more. And he says, well, he was one of the founders of the Renaissance period in Florence, Italy. This is in the mid-1400s. And his contemporaries were, Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci and Caravaggio, Donatello. And they were, doing this amazing art in Florence and, of course, Rome. And so what they would do, make up these carvings, and sometimes they would turn it into a marble, sculpture. Sometimes they would just sell it kind of like it was. And I just fell in love with it. And so I asked him, I said, well, what did you do? He says, well, I bought it and I shipped it to my home in Beverly Hills, and it was in my study. And it just kind of sat there. And then when I moved out to Hawaii, it didn't fit, so I put it into storage. And I'm like, well, what did that cost you? And he said, $60,000. And I'm like, $60,000 in like 1969? He says, yeah. He says, you want it? I said, I sure do. I'll take that. I'm no dummy. I went to Auburn. It's one of many pieces of memorabilia we have actually from Jim Nabors. We have this pool table that actually Michael Jackson played on, Ronald Reagan played on it, Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. and Lucille Ball and Carol Burnett, Burt Reynolds, Lonnie Anderson. I mean, all these people came and played on this pool table that is now available for our guests to play on. It's a historic table, but Michael Jackson actually played on that table. He was Jim Nabors in his variety hour. He was the first show ever to put the Jackson 5 on national TV. And so he built this friendship with the Jackson family. And, he and Michael Jackson stayed in touch kind of through Michael's life. And he used to, but when he was a kid, he used to come over and play pool on that particular table.
And that's one of the things that, starting this business, this resort, from scratch. I mean, you've been able to really infuse all of these little pieces of it together that have made it what it is, whether it's obviously you were involved in the design of everything, or, the artwork on the wall, or the pool table in the club bar, and these kinds of things. I mean, you've been able from the very beginning, like, this is your project, and that's got to be pretty rewarding to be able to walk around here now.
Yeah, it's cool because there's a lot of history, even about, there was a resort less than a mile from here that operated 100 years ago in Talladega Springs, and there's a lot of history there. Fort Williams, which is where Andrew Jackson, he had all his troops come down in like 1814, and from there they went to Horseshoe Bend to take on the Red Stick Creek Indians that were, there was a skirmish going on, and they came right across the farm. There's some breastworks on the farm that supposedly, and we've heard archaeologists say this, that DeSoto came here and maybe, camped on the farm. And what's funny is I always thought that DeSoto was the oldest thing, but no, it's the piece of artwork that's hanging on our wall. The Luca Della Robbia actually predates Hernando de Soto by 100 years. But, Sylacauga has the widest marble in the world. The largest outcropping of calcium deposits in the world is right here in this county. The only person ever hit by a meteorite happened in Sylacauga, Alabama. The Hodges meteorite, 1954. A woman got struck. She was she was sitting on her bed watching, I think, the Ed Sullivan Show or something, and a 10-pound meteorite comes through her roof and hits her on her leg. You're having a bad day when you get hit by a meteorite, I will say that. But
so you've got this incredible place. Where do you vacation?
Oh, I tell you what, I love going.
This is a vacation for everyone else.
Yes.
And so you live here. Where do you and Ellen go vacation?
We have a lake house down on Lake Martin. We love to go there. But we're actually going to Israel here in a couple of months. We go to the Greenbrier. We love the Greenbrier. But we like going new places and to really just – we're always taking pictures and making notes about things that are unique. I think that people are drawn to story, and they're certainly drawn to uniqueness. Anybody can go to a Courtyard Marriott or a Renaissance Hotel or something like that, and they're nice, but there's no real story there. There's not like a backstory. So it can be a great place to stay, but any place that you can go and you can learn, you can walk away with memories and stories, I think that makes for a much better overall vacation.
Well, where does Purcell Farms go from here? What's your vision for the future? What's on the horizon for Purcell Farms?
So I'm beginning to look into some development opportunities out here. There's the possibility of, you know, maybe building 9 more holes of golf. I mean, there's a lot of things we could expand somewhat. Right now we're just in execution mode. We've been open since March of last year, kind of with everything open now. So it's kind of like we want to get better before we get bigger. And once we really get everything working to Ellen's and my satisfaction, then we'll start thinking about next steps. But, we love what we're doing. We love hosting people here. I mean, sometimes I'll walk in the front of the inn and I'll see an old friend that I didn't know was even here, and they're here with the family. Or I get an email from somebody that says, hey, I was just here this past weekend. So we don't have to go far to see people now. That's true.
And your family has stayed a part of the business, which is really kind of interesting, given the fact that, you know, your father married into the business and took over the business, and then you took over the business, and now I know you've got other family members of yours that are really heavily involved in the business. And so that's another common thread, I think, that has run through Purcell Farms and its history throughout.
Yeah. So family, I got a son, Parker, who's coming up through the family business and really doing the same thing I did, doing different jobs that I did years ago, but really going about it the same way. Really, really bright young man. We have great talks. We have lunches every week. My son-in-law works here as our director of marketing, Tim. He's married to my daughter, Vaughn, who is our artist in residence, and she's an amazing artist. I mean, she's so much better than I am. My wife is our decorator here. All of my kids are huge supporters and huge advocates of Purcell Farms. And, we're just having a good time. And we're living the dream here.
Well, good. I'm glad that you continue to enjoy the view. And most of all, we're just thankful for you being a guest on our podcast and really appreciate the time, David.
Thank you. Thank you so much.